Penguin Random House Audio presents The Key to Rebecca by Ken Follett. Read for you by Tim Downey.
Our spy in Cairo is the greatest hero of them all. Irvin Rommel, September 1942. Part 1. Tobruk. Chapter 1. The last camel collapsed at noon. It was the 5-year-old white bull he had bought in Gallo, the youngest and strongest of the three beasts and the least ill-tempered. He liked the animal as much as a man could like a camel, which is to say that he hated it only a little. They climbed the leeward side of a small hill, man and camel planting big clumsy feet in the inconstant sand, and at the top they stopped. They looked ahead, seeing nothing but another hillock to climb and after that a thousand more, and it was as if the camel despaired at the thought. Its forelegs folded, then its rear went down, and it crouched on top of the hill like a monument, searing across the empty desert with the indifference of the dying. The man hauled on its nose rope. Its head came forward and its neck stretched out, but it would not get up. The man went behind and kicked its hindquarters as hard as he could 3 or 4 times. Finally, he took out a razor-sharp curved Bedouin knife with a narrow point and stabbed the camel's rump. Blood flowed from the wound, but the camel did not even look round. The man understood what was happening. The very tissues of the animal's body, starved of nourishment, had simply stopped working like a machine that has run out of fuel. He had seen camels collapse like this on the outskirts of an oasis, surrounded by life-giving foliage which they ignored, lacking the energy to eat. There were 2 more tricks he might have tried. One was to pour water into its nostrils until it began to drown. The other, to light a fire under its hindquarters. He could not spare the water for one, nor the firewood for the other. And besides, neither method had a great chance of success. It was time to stop, anyway. The sun was high and fierce. The long Saharan summer was beginning, and the midday temperature would reach 110 degrees in the shade. Without unloading the camel, the man opened one of his bags and took out his tent. He looked round again, automatically. There was no shade or shelter in sight. One place was as bad as another. He pitched his tent beside the dying camel, there on top of the hillock. He sat cross-legged in the open end of the tent to make his tea. He scraped level a small square of sand, arranged a few precious dry twigs in a pyramid and lit the fire. When the kettle boiled, he made tea in the nomad fashion, pouring it from the pot into the cup, adding sugar, then returning it to the pot to infuse again, several times over. The resulting brew, very strong and very treacly, was the most reviving drink in the world. He gnawed at some dates and watched the camel die whilst he waited for the sun to pass overhead. His tranquility was practiced. Come a long way in this desert, more than 1,000 miles. 2 months earlier, he had left El Agila on the Mediterranean coast of Libya and travelled due south for 500 miles via Jalo and Kufra, into the empty heart of the Sahara. There he had turned east and crossed the border into Egypt, unobserved by man or beast. He had traversed the rocky wasteland of the western desert and turned north near Khareg. Now he was not far from his destination. He knew the desert, but he was afraid of it. All intelligent men were, even the nomads who lived all their lives here. But he never allowed that fear to take hold of him, to panic him, to use up his nervous energy. There were always catastrophes. Mistakes in navigation that made you miss a well by a couple of miles, water bottles that leaked or burst. Apparently, healthy camels had got sick a couple of days out. The only response was to say, Insha'Allah, it is the will of God. Eventually, the sun began to dip towards the west. He looked at the camel's load, wondering how much of it he could carry. There were 3 small European suitcases, 2 heavy and 1 light, all important. There was a little bag of clothes, a sextant, the maps and the water bottle. It was already too much. He would have to abandon the tent, the tea set, the cooking pot, the almanac and the saddle. He made the 3 cases into a bundle and tied the clothes and the sextant on top, strapping the lot together with a length of cloth. He could put his arms through the cloth straps and carry the load like a rucksack on his back. He slung the goatskin water bag round his neck and let it dangle in front. It was a heavy load. 3 months earlier, he would have been able to carry it all day, then play tennis in the evening. But he was a strong man. But the desert had weakened him. His bowels were water. His skin was a mass of sores, and he had lost 20 or 30 pounds. Without the camel, he could not go far. Holding his compass in his hand, he started walking. He followed the compass wherever it led, resisting the temptation to divert round the hills, for he was navigating by dead reckoning over the final miles, and a fractional error could take him a fatal few hundred yards astray. He settled into a slow, long-strided walk, his mind emptied of hopes and fears, and he concentrated on the compass and the sand. He managed to forget the pain of his ravaged body and put one foot in front of the other automatically, without thought and therefore without effort. The day cooled into evening. The water bottle became lighter round his neck as he consumed its contents. He refused to think about how much water was left. He was drinking 6 pints every 24 hours. He had calculated, and he knew there was not enough for another day. A flock of birds flew over his head, whistling noisily. He looked up, shading his eyes with his hand, and recognized them as Liechtenstein sand grouse, desert birds like brown pigeons that flocked to water every morning and evening. They were heading the same way as he was, which meant he was on the right track, but he knew they could fly 50 miles to water, so he could take little encouragement from them. Clouds gathered on the horizon as the desert cooled. Behind him, the sun sank lower and turned into a big yellow balloon. A little later, a white moon appeared in the purple sky. He thought about stopping. Nobody could walk all night. But he had no tent, no blanket, no rice, and no tea. And he was sure he was close to the well. By his reckoning, he should have been there. He walked on. His calm was deserting him now. He had set his strength and his expertise against the ruthless desert, and it began to look as if the desert would win. He thought again of the camel he had left behind and how it had sat on the hillock with the tranquility of exhaustion, waiting for death. He would not wait for death, he thought. When it became inevitable, he would rush to meet it. Nor for him the hours of agony and encroaching madness. That would be undignified. He had his knife. The thought made him feel desperate, and now he could no longer repress the fear. The moon went down, but the landscape was bright with starlight. He saw his mother in the distance, and she said, "Don't say I never warned you." He heard a railway train that chugged along with his heartbeat, slowly. Small rocks moved in his path like scampering rats. He smelt roast lamb. He breasted a rise and saw, close by, the red glow of the fire over which the meat had been roasted, and a small boy beside it gnawing the bones. There were the tents round the fire, the hobbled camels grazing the scattered thorns, and the wellhead beyond. He walked into the hallucination. The people in the dream looked up at him, startled. A tall man stood up and spoke. The traveller pulled at his howlie, unwinding the cloth to reveal his face. The tall man stepped forward, shocked, and said, "My cousin." The traveller understood that this was not, after all, an illusion, and he smiled faintly and collapsed. When he awoke, he thought for a moment that he was a boy again and that his adult life had been a dream. Someone was touching his shoulder and saying, "Wake up, Ahmed," in the tongue of the desert. Nobody had called him Ahmed for years. He realized he was wrapped in a coarse blanket and lying on the cold sand, his head swathed in a howlie. He opened his eyes to see the gorgeous sunrise like a straight rainbow against the flat black horizon. The icy morning wind blew into his face. In that instant, he experienced again all the confusion and anxiety of his 15th year. It felt utterly lost that first time he woke up in the desert. He had thought, "My father is dead. And then, I have a new father." Snatches from the surahs of the Quran had run through his head, mixed with bits of the creed which his mother still taught him secretly in German. He remembered the recent sharp pain of his adolescent circumcision, followed by the cheers and rifle shots of the men as they congratulated him on at last becoming one of them, a true man. Then there had been the long train journey, wondering what his desert cousins would be like and whether they would despise his pale body and his city ways. He'd walked briskly out of the railway station and seen the two Arabs sitting beside their camels in the dust of the station yard, wrapped in traditional robes which covered them from head to foot, except for the slit in the howlie which revealed only their dark, unreadable eyes. They had taken him to the well. It had been terrifying. Nobody had spoken to him except in gestures. In the evening he had realized that these people had no toilets and he became desperately embarrassed. In the end, he'd been forced to ask. There was a moment of silence,
Sample complete. Ready to continue?